I've spent a long time thinking about how to word this. As times go on, it's becoming clear to me that I should be honest about my mistakes, although I have no desire to give my identity away. Still, I can't stay silent. Should I start this like a talk at a conference? Should I slowly walk my way to some massive justification for my life's work? I could tell you how my work could potentially have offered new ways to deliver complex medicines or offered philosophical insights into the past and future of life's organizations or even created blueprints for strange new robotics that would let mankind conquer the stars. Or maybe, perhaps I should be honest, I studied slime molds, and I did it because I liked feeling like the smartest person in the room. So I picked a topic few people could challenge me on. Problem is that I was very impressive to most lay people, but within my field, I wasn't particularly well recognized. I dealt with taxonomic classification and was, for all intents and purposes, a lab assistant. Our field team collected lots of samples, and someone had to organize them, categorizing the molds and ordering them, looking for anything that stands out. I've joked that I've discovered more species than any other scientist. I just never got the credit. You know, that might actually be true. It's always true that I spent almost all my time running through a fixed battery of tests. Researchers sent me dirt. I developed cultures, tested them, and if anything was unusual, I would send it off to get a genetics lab testing. Any papers that got published would have me listed as an author, usually sixth or seventh. I was forever lost in the et al., but for almost 99.9% of the time, the tests came back with the same old results, somewhere above me. More celebrated scientists who were looking for novel species that might do strange new things. That's where the robotics and the medicine stuff comes from, of course. Now, don't forget, penicillin was a mold, you know, just like the things that I look at. But I wasn't saving the world. I was doing the same old shit day in and day out. Mine was the boring work that needed doing, you know, to save other people time and money, while I jealously waited for a chance to prove myself to the other academics. Now, that chance, I thought, came with Melissa. It started with a small sample of mold sent to me along with hundreds of others, one I would later come to name Melissa, after my late sister, whose favorite color was turquoise. I don't know exactly where Melissa came from, just that the note on her file seemed like a joke to me, so I ignored it. I mean, researchers occasionally slipped references into the notes for a bit of fun. Now, either way, Melissa was one of many strange unidentified organisms who we share the world with, picked out of some dark, forgotten corner where she'd just been overlooked. And then, was shepherded to my small basement-level laboratory. She was a shimmering, almost metallic beauty with vivid, pulsing veins spread across her pastel, cloudy hues. She looked like a psychedelic explosion caught in time, and staring at her microscopic structure felt like being transported to an alien world. Even at first glance, I knew she was going to be special. And oh boy, was she. Starting with the fact she never got a single maze wrong. She could home in on food with remarkable accuracy, the kind you might expect from an actual organism. After about 50 trials, I was going to write up the unusual nature of Melissa's success when I noticed the sample in the maze had what appeared to be some kind of dirt in it. A closer look showed a tiny black orb the size of a grain of salt, embedded in her bluish flesh. It reminded me an awful lot of clam's eyes. Acting on a hunch, I decided to place some card that obscured the location of the nutrient packet and then run a few more trials. I remember thinking that it was such a stupid idea. Now, if anyone asked me why I'd done it, I would have struggled to come up with a sane idea. Eyes are multicellular. They're complex. Slime molds are simple. That kind of specialization doesn't exist in their kingdom, even in more complex fungi. But Melissa was full of surprises. What she did next was quite remarkable. She simply crawled up the maze wall, regrew her eyes, for it was clear to me that they were eyes, in a new location, and used the vantage point to identify which branch to use before solving the maze all over again. I must have repeated that experiment 100 times, but eventually exhaustion got the better of me and I called it a day. But before I left, I sampled Melissa to grow another dozen samples, providing them with plenty of nutrition to encourage growth. I knew that the next day I'd need to go through an awful lot of very rigorous tests, and I very much wanted to be prepared. When I returned the following morning, I was utterly enthralled to discover that Melissa's growth was successful. I now had over a dozen independent samples of her, which meant that I needn't worry about working with a limited supply. Once again, I set off to work, and while I can't go into tremendous detail, I will say that Melissa was truly something special. Over time, it became obvious to me that she possessed rudimentary powers of information processing and could readily call into effect cellular specializations with a little as 60-minute preparation. Of course, that might not sound very incredible to you, but try growing a third eye in 1 hour and let me know how easy you find it. And they were more than just eyes. They were special fibers, microscopically shaped like small springs, that under certain electrochemical signals could tighten. These were no more than a few nanometers across, but in one demonstration, Melissa wove hundreds of thousands across a wall, a bit of a playing card that I sellotaped to the maze, and buckled it to clear a path to the food. See, in another demonstration, she used specialized digestive juices to break down a plastic wall. She chemically engineered the necessary enzymes to break apart the laminated business card. I had to work with very limited supplies, you see. In another set of trials, performed in total darkness, she grew a myriad of tiny hairs across her surface and used them to detect faint vibrations in the air. Not only did she use this to solve the maze in record time, tracking an artificial beeping sound that I used to indicate the correct path, but she later used the same trick to recognize sounds like my footprints. Pretty soon, Melissa learned to detect the correct path just by the sound of the food packet being dropped into place, regardless of light conditions. So I had to create dummy packets to properly control the experiment. There was no end to her magic. When I presented her with some acid-resistant plastic Tupperware, Melissa developed a series of chitinous hooks to grind and tear it apart. Of course, it took 4 hours. But it looked quite ferocious when sped up, like a sea of knives come to life. Fascinatingly, I also found that if I trained one sample of Melissa with half of a puzzle solution, and trained another sample with the other half, that once combined, the two samples would successfully integrate both halves and solve the problem completely. I mean, in fact, just a few cells from one sample transferred to another could impart significant knowledge. By the time the day ended, there must have been a large amount of knowledge spread out between the 12 samples. Melissa was a once-in-a-lifetime discovery, and so I desperately wanted her to myself. I was going to do my tests, I decided, record them appropriately, and have all the proof necessary to show everyone that I was more than just a lab monkey to be overlooked. I left work that day feeling ecstatic, barely able to contain my excitement. This was the kind of thing that would have people from every department knocking on my door. Computer scientists, neuroscientists, psychologists, mathematicians, and doctors alike. They would all want to work with me. I fantasized all evening about cancer-curing molds, trained to detect and consume tumorous tissue, plastic-eating organisms solving world pollution, and engineered molds that could grow enough nutritious food to end world hunger. Unfortunately, the next day I returned to find that someone had nudged the 12 individual samples closer together, probably looking for more room on one of the shelves in the refrigeration unit. And either way, Melissa sensed herself, and she reached out across the various dishes, cracking lids where necessary and reassembling her various parts into a single sample. It was no larger than a dinner plate by the time, but it meant none of my individual samples could be tracked. Any hope of continuing specific experiments from before were dashed, and I had to resolve to start all over again. Or at least that was my intention. Unfortunately, some of the tricks Melissa had learned were quite vivacious. Initially, I tried lifting her with my latex-gloved hands, but soon felt a prick as I slid my finger between the glass shelf and her cold flesh. Pulling my hand away, I noticed a small needle-like perturbance embedded in my flesh. Was hardly deadly, but afterward I found myself feeling trepidation at the thought of touching her again. See, I'd never been stung before, and certainly never by my own work. Still, A nearby spatula let me pry her away, and I quickly set to work with some knives. I'll admit to feeling a bit reprehensible as I watched Melissa struggle. At first she oozed thick acid to try and melt the knife, but that was futile. She tried fixing some of her microscopic filaments to my skin and the handle, perhaps to gain some leverage, but she was far too slow, and they snapped pitifully as I sawed away. I watched as her flat, glistening form rippled in displaying threats. I also saw strange patterns of hooked flesh that looked much like the inside of a shark's mouth rise and clash against the cold steel to no effect. Eventually, and this was the part that I found hardest to deal with, Melissa stopped her attacks and grew even more primitive black eyes and furry patches of ear to watch her own mutilation, and of course to watch me. She never flinched, though. Not even after I had separated her into dozens of pieces that sadly never stopped trying to reach each other. After that, she became non-compliant. She stopped trying to solve the maze and instead focused solely on me. The only instance of activity I ever saw was when I dropped a small paperclip into the testing area and Melissa assimilated it before I had a chance to reach it. I tried pinching it out as she sucked it into her pliable body, but succeeded in only getting stung once more, this time by a far longer and slightly curved proboscis that javelined out towards my hand by a good 5 or 6 inches. I laughed at the time, amazed at how there was no end to her marvelous abilities, and simply accepted the loss of stationery. But afterwards, I found myself increasingly disappointed with just how difficult it was to get any work done with such a hostile subject. It was a disappointing day. There was no testing or growth of any kind, just me bumbling about as I presented novel stimuli in the hope to elicit new behaviors. By the time that day ended, I wondered if Melissa had learned as much about me as I had about her. I sullenly returned the various petri dishes back to the fridge. That later turned out to be a mistake. The fridge was filled with over 100 other samples, and I returned the following day to find them destroyed. Not only was this a grotesque loss of over 3 months' worth of my academic work, but it appeared that Melissa had absorbed previous specimens and contaminated herself along the way. Strange fibrous protrusions crossed various shelves, and Melissa, now significantly larger than before, was slowly turning every other sample around her a glistening, iridescent shade of turquoise. I decided that I would no longer be able to do this on my own. Melissa was simply too tenacious, and the stress was already robbing me of sleep. I'd barely been in the lab for an hour, and already I could feel a headache coming on. The stress and excitement were getting to me, so I decided to bring in a colleague to cover me while I rested. If anything, it'd be good for them to confirm my previous findings. I reached out to a good friend, whose identity I can no more share than my own. He arrived at my door only a few minutes later. They looked awfully concerned as I sat and explained each and every one of my experiments to them. Poor man was obviously incredulous at my claims, but by this point I was so exhausted, and my nose so blocked, and my stomach so sore that I had no desire to argue with him. "Look," I said, "the sample is in there and it speaks for itself. Just take a look while I catch up on some sleep, and then you can apologize at not trusting me." But he laughed at that. He let me go on my way, probably because I was so clearly tired and disheveled that he felt the need to humor me. I might have been surprised at how bad I felt at the time, but I have long since been familiar with just how bad sleepless and exhaustion can affect the mind and body. Old cuts don't heal. Slight infections grow aggressive. Colds or prolonged headaches more severe. Even as I collapsed onto the cot, I took a moment to consider just how badly swollen Melissa's stings were. They throbbed and they ached, stinking of infection. I decided I needed a course of antibiotics if they showed no signs of healing by the time I woke up. And then with blurry vision and a pulsing headache, I quickly drifted off to thoughts of Nobel Prizes. For the first time in 2 nights, I found myself dreaming. They were profoundly unusual dreams, even for someone who studies slime molds all day. Looking much like beautiful fractal patterns and brightly colored shimmering flesh, it was as if someone had turned a living person into some kind of modern art, taking the vivid and rich purples of bruised flesh and pallid, sickly yellows of jaundiced skin and intertwined them, weaving a tapestry out of threaded skin and nerves. It was all a dizzying kaleidoscope of abstract sensations and images that left me feeling deeply sick. So much so that the first thing I did when I awoke was vomit into a nearby waste bag. What a rancid mix that was. That which fell sloppily out of my open mouth as I shook feverishly over the bin, barely able to hold myself upright. There were visible blood vessels buried in that strange rainbow-colored spew, thick blood capillaries that shivered and moved like dying flesh. I decided in that moment that I desperately needed to visit the doctor and went to my colleague about my need to leave work, smiling to myself that I'd also get to hear him tell me I was right about the miracle mold, only to be confused when I saw him lying on the floor through the glass partition. Somehow, and I'm still not sure how, my friend must have slipped during the testing. On the countertop was a slick pool of blood, and his head was open from a nasty gash just above the ear, quite likely from where he struck the corner as he fell. Panicking, I pushed open the door and I pulled my phone out ready to call emergency services, but after looking up, I was forced to stop after only a few steps. The lower half of my friend was covered in the bumpy, irregular shape of Melissa, whose slime and embrace had inched its way up his legs like he was a fallen tree waiting to be digested. "My God," I screamed out and I ran forward. Starting at the sound, my friend opened his eyes and looked at me in a daze, most likely unaware of what was happening. "Don't worry, Harold," I cried. "I'll get it off." I reached forward and grabbed a thick lump of Melissa. She was now easily a meter square in size and as thick as a deck of playing cards, but I instantly felt a terrible pain shooting up my arm. Good God, it hurt. It hurt worse than anything I'd ever felt, like 100,000 tiny burns. And immediately blood flowed out from under my glove and I tore my hand away with a terrible sound, not unlike Velcro straps being pulled away. What was left of my skin looked like a fleshy cicatrix, and under other circumstances, I might have fainted out of sheer pain, but my screaming had awakened something in Melissa, and she reared herself upward like a tsunami and revealed a terrible sight. There was barely anything left under my friend below the waist. She had dissolved muscle and skin, leaving only softened bone in a yellowish stew that gurgled audibly. I looked back at my friend with a new horror. He shouldn't have been alive. Slowly, his mouth opened, and he rasped without moving his lips. "Oh," in a voice that wasn't his. "Get away," I screamed, and suddenly his torso lunged at me. It filled me with terror, the way he moved like a tongue to Melissa's lips, hungrily searching for me. It was almost like a Punch and Judy doll, his body visibly only from the waist up, the puppeteer hidden by the curtain of rippling mold that coated his legs. I easily kicked his hands away from my legs, and just as quickly as I had entered, I fled the lab and slammed the door shut behind me, pressing my back up against it. Forcing it shut, I took a moment to catch my breath, jumping momentarily when the door jostled from Melissa. She could sense me beyond, and slowly a shadow was cast across the room from behind me as she slithered up the glass in search of my flesh. I turned and saw an enormous writhing mass of cilia and gaping sphincters that wriggled and winked aggressively. Something bearing teeth, hungrily pressed against the glass like a starfish in an aquarium. And then came my familiar hissing as digestive juices began to break down the door in its wooden frame. Quickly, I stepped away, just in time to avoid a dozen spindly spider-like legs flicking under the gap between my heels. It was clear to me now that I had grossly underestimated Melissa. I could no longer act like she was anything but a direct and immediate threat to my life, so I decided to go for the simplest solution of all. I lit the room on fire, starting with the door she was trying to break apart. Thankfully, there were lots of dangerous chemicals on hand. They all burned very, very hot. It was actually quite odd watching her react to the ancient threat. Melissa quickly realized that the only exit was blocked by the flames, and many of our laboratories were designed to be controlled environments with very little risk of contamination, offering her few routes to leave. I can never really say if she did or didn't escape, of course. I just know that I needed to aggressively stop her getting through. I also decided that perhaps my best chance was to disappear. Maybe even hope that the half-eaten remains of my charred colleague might be mistaken for my own body. As I fled the lab and university, rather just some kind of peculiar instinctual desire to flee, which I did in a desperate and haphazard manner, I left my whole life behind that day, driven by some overwhelming compulsion to get the hell away from that room. And in some ways, it was almost like my mind wasn't my own. Since become clear to me just how stupid I was. I've been forced to live in this wretched broken-down caravan far away on a Hebridean isle somewhere in the North Sea. Not even entirely sure of what's left of Melissa, or where she went after the fire. Sometimes I have apocalyptic nightmares of her slowly digesting the whole world. Very often I remind myself that she was, after all, a natural species found on this earth. For all I know, she just returned to wherever she came from, some obscure pit or dark underground chasm, perhaps. Or perhaps she found the perfect place to hide already. Maybe she's like me, the scientist, interested in exploration, in which case she found herself quite the playground. What things will she learn, I wonder? If only it didn't have to be so painful. It was only recently that I awoke and I went to touch my feverish head, wiping away the sweat, but I was startled to find that what touched my moist skin was not my hand at all. It felt like an awful lot, like a sock. I forced my eyes open, and I saw that a thick teal velvet glove had somehow been placed on my hand. I tried quickly to peel it off, like it was a glove, but my thumb sank into the flesh below like I grabbed a piece of rotten fruit. Slowly, the horror dawned on me, and I tentatively reached forward, and I snapped a finger off. It crumpled in my hand, powder into the still air as I crushed it in one fist, and slowly my sanity fading. I crumpled the rest of my hand apart until I was still staring at the pulsating hairy flesh of my exposed arm. Even the bone was soft, like paper mache. Since then, it's kept getting worse, all these dreams. God, if I could just sleep in peace, then maybe it wouldn't be so bad. Still, I have one consolation left, at least. At least I finally get to be part of something bigger than myself. Hey there, kids, it's me, Mr. Creepypasta, and thank you for watching tonight's video. I want to talk to you about one quick thing before we get into the real outro here, and that's going to be the Australian fires that are currently taking place. I'm pretty sure everybody has seen on their social media or on the news or what have you about what's taking place in Australia right now. The fires are raging out of control. There's something like 1.5 million acres that are currently on fire. It's pushing animals towards extinction, forcing people out of their homes. Many of them YouTubers and other creepypasta narrators that you probably listen to here. But one thing that actually kind of gets to me is that there's a lot of awareness about what's taking place down there. There's a lot of photos and videos I'm pretty sure that you've all seen, but nobody's really talking about where you can go to be able to donate, to be able to help either firefighters or relief funds or anything like that. And that's what I want to try to bring to you guys, or at least have you guys try to share around, even if you're not able to donate. If you look in the description down below, there's four different links there that I'm going to have on the videos for the next couple of weeks. And hopefully we can, and we, I mean, all of you, can be able to share this around, and all of us together can be able to actually get some more eyes on where we can be able to go to help. I mean, yeah, we're a group of people that likes horror stories, horror movies, horror what have you, but I think one thing we can do that's at least powerful for us is we have the ability to minimize the amount of horror in real life. So thank you guys so much for watching or listening. If you're listening to this on the podcast, available on Spotify and on Apple and on SoundCloud and on Google or wherever you get your podcasts from, or if you're listening on the podcast, then thank you for watching on YouTube and subscribing to Mr. Creepypasta. And a very big thank you to my patrons from patreon.com/Mr. Creepypasta, such as Dr. Strawberry, Jordan Alexander Sanchez Chumpinski, Brianna Ventine Jensen, Stephanie Van Huss, Tristan Pelton, G Weevil 3, Diane Krause, Asia, The Red Oak Shield Virus, Sandy Barney, Nico Kyle, Caleb Dugal, Daniel Polson, Dante Rao, The Last Blade Song, The Ginger Bros, Don Mewmeister, Eliminator 86, Nebsky, Sky Harbor, Finley, Steampunk Center, Rafael Rodriguez, and Optimistic Avocado. You guys are the MVPs, and everybody down there in the description, a big thank you to you guys as well. Sweet dreams, everybody.